Well, our hope and our prayer is that during this series, we all embrace that idea, that phrase, I am a missionary. So let's say it together. Ready? I, come on now, say it like you just won the Powerball, okay? I am a missionary. Reality is that all of us, whether you're here today and you're a Christian or you're not a Christian, we're all missionaries. We're missionaries for something or someone that has captivated our hearts. If I were to sit down and talk to you, it wouldn't take me very long probably to figure out what or whom you are on mission for. And like I said, if you're here today and you say, I'm checking Christianity out, I'm not a believer yet, one of the things that you have to account for is how does it go from this small little, handful of disciples around the time of Jesus to this worldwide gospel movement that has lasted over a couple thousand years? And that answer to that, I guess, at least in part, is that God used a guy named Paul. Now, some of us call me Apostle Paul. Some of you may have heard Saint Paul. However you say it, God used him and a small group of folks that traveled with him, and they would go city to city to city, telling this subversive message of the gospel. And so what's so subversive about the message? Well, Rome was in control of the world in that day, and the Caesars had statements, and at times they would force people to make these statements. I'll throw one of them up here just so you can see it, read it, feel it. It's Kaiser Kurios. Now, you say, man, what does that mean? Well, you actually know the word, even if you don't know you know the word. For a lot of you, because you love fantastic 1980s music, you know that word. Because you remember the song, Kyrie Eleison? You remember that song? Some of you are looking at me like I'm crazy. So I'll give you a little snippet of the song. While the song's up, I'll show you a picture of the band. Maybe that'll jog your memory. You're starting to nod a little bit like that, sing along. So somebody, who remembers what the band was? Remember the band? Who was the band? Anybody? Got the band? Who said what? Mr. Who said Mr. right there? Who said that? Yeah, come here. I got something for you. Here is an authentic Mr. CD, greatest hits. There you go, right there. Thank you. And if you saw the picture of the band, by the way, the guy down on the front right, that's Pastor Jeff from back in the 80s. So take that to him. He'll autograph that up for you, okay? Kyrie eleison. It's actually a phrase that comes from the Greek Orthodox Church. It means Lord, have mercy. So when Mr. sang it, Lord, have mercy in the darkness of the night. Lord, have mercy on the road that I'm traveling or that I must travel. So Kaiser Kurios. Caesar would force people to say that Caesar is Lord. But Paul teaches this subversive message as he travels. And he says to people, it's not that Caesar is Lord, it's that Jesus is Lord. And the Caesar of all the Caesars, Caesar Augustus, an inscription has been found that he had written about himself. And again, I'll throw it up here and I'll just read it out loud to you. It says, salvation is to be found in none other save Augustus, and there is no other name given to men in which they can be saved. Paul travels with this little band of merry men, and Acts 4:12, there is no other name given under heaven among men, speaking of Jesus, whereby not we can be, but we must be saved. This subversive message of the gospel began to penetrate city to city to city. So Paul and his little team, they would travel on different missionary trips and missionary journeys, and on their second missionary journey, what happens is, the Jerusalem was kind of the hub of Christianity down here. But what happens is this missionary global movement, eventually the hub is kind of Antioch. And so Paul and his band of guys, they leave there, they travel along the coast. They hit some of these cities, planting churches. These journeys took a long time. And eventually, they land right there in Athens. Now, Athens was the academic hub of the Greco-Roman world. And when Paul gets there, he's been run out of another city and guys are kind of chasing him. So he left some other guys. He kind of sneaks out of town on his own. He gets to Athens and he's all by himself. And when he gets there, he sees the city and he sees what's going on in the city. And it provokes him. This spirit just provokes him. I'll read to you what happened. Acts chapter 17, verse 16, and then we'll skip to 22 and 23. Now, while Paul was waiting for them at Athens, his spirit was provoked within him, and he saw that the city was full of idols. So Paul, standing in the midst of the Areopagus or Mars Hill, said, "Men of Athens, I perceive that in every way you are very religious. For as I passed along, I observed the objects of your worship, and I also found an altar with this inscription, 'To the unknown God.' What, therefore, you worship as unknown, this is what I proclaim to you." Paul goes to really the philosophical, the educational, the epicenter in Athens, this place, Mars Hill. I'll show you a picture of Mars Hill. The rock in the front is Mars Hill, where Paul would have stood. In the background, you'll see the Acropolis, which was kind of the commercial, cultural, entertainment center of Athens, where all of these idols would have been strung out. So many of them, they want to make sure they cover them all. One was called to the unknown God. What is it in Paul that is provoked to the degree that he just all on his own, all by himself, goes up and begins to stand and proclaim? It's that what he perceived in Athens is that there were lots and lots and lots of people worshiping, lots and lots and lots of idols, but that they were far away from the God that he knew. And I would just say that our world today is really no different. There's 7 billion people-ish on the planet. And of those 7 billion people, about 2.8 billion of them have little or no access to the gospel. Now, I was trying to think of a way this week that I could say that to you in a visual way. So here's what we're going to do. I'm going to have everybody stand up, if you will, this audience participation. Everybody stand up to your feet. And let's say that we all represent the 7 billion people who live on the planet. So some of you back there, you know, you're the Far East and China and that part, and some of you are Europe and South America. We represent 7 billion people on the planet. So this section on the far left, you guys all sit down. This next section on the left, you guys all sit down. And you guys back there in the back section, you all sit down in the middle back section. And then the first 5 or 6 rows in the back of this front section, you all sit down. And all the people who are still standing represent the number of people in the world who have never heard the name Jesus. And it's not just that they've never heard it. They don't have access to it. They don't have the opportunity to hear it. You guys, go ahead and have a seat. Thank you. And I think that what we would say, or at least what we should say as Christians, as believers, is that for 2.8 billion people to live in our world and have little or no access to the gospel, that is intolerable to us as Christians and as believers. So, what do they do in the book of Acts? What should we do today? Quite honestly, they're not dissimilar from each other. I'm going to give you 3 practical things as we begin to approach this series over the next couple of weeks that you can engage in. Number one is praying. Every Tuesday via social media, Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, we push out a prayer request, what we call Tuesday 10-2. It's based on Luke 10-2, the verse where Jesus commands us, Christians, believers, to pray that God would send more people to more places in the world so that God would get more praise. More people, more places, more praise, because God deserves honor and glory. So he commands us to pray. And so on Tuesdays, we take a different facet of the world, one of our different mission partners around the world, and we just pray together towards that end. So I would say, number one, begin praying. We're praying that not only on our short-term trips where we get our feet on foreign soil for maybe a short amount of time, but we're praying that over the next 10 years, God would send 100 people from our church on longer-term missions around the world, longer than just a week or 2 weeks. We're praying that God would send 100 of us over the next 10 years so that we can somehow be part of making a dent in 2.8 billion people who do not have what you have. Praying. The second thing's fasting. And I know when you bring this up, it's kind of a weird concept to some people sometimes. Like, why would you fast? Here's the purpose of fasting in as short a way as I can say it to you. Fasting is giving up one activity to be replaced. That time that you would spend on one activity, you replace that with a different activity. So in Scripture, there are moments, there are seasons, there are times when the church gets together and they fast. Either they give up food, and the time that they would have spent eating, they spend that time praying. Maybe for us today, maybe the fast for you looks different. Maybe it's a fast from social media. Maybe it's a fast from watching TV or something, that hobby that you have that you spend your time on. So I'm gonna be real practical with you today. And I'm gonna ask you this week, as we approach this series, I wanna ask you this week to fast with us as a congregation. From Tuesday evening, if it's a fast for you from food, maybe you eat dinner on Tuesday night and you fast the rest of the night, Tuesday night, and throughout the day on Wednesday until we come back here to the worship night on Wednesday night, and we will pray and we'll break the fast at that point. Again, maybe that's a social media fast for you. You spend that time praying. Maybe it's what you would have done watching TV and you spend that praying. Maybe it's whatever it is that you would have done. We want to spend 24 hours together asking God to help us know how it is that we need to be involved with reaching the 2.8 billion people in the world who have little or no access to the gospel. Praying, fasting, and the third one's offering. Two Sundays from now, on the third week of this series, we'll receive our only public offering of the year. And it'll be 2 times, 3 times, 4 times, sometimes 5 times our normal Sunday offering. It'll be our largest offering of the year, that day and that week, and everything that's given on that Sunday and that week. I have no problem asking you to give sacrificially, because all of those resources go outside the walls of our church to help us reach, to go to mid-Ohio, the Midwest, and the world, to take the gospel to places where we don't see the evidence, the practical evidence of a church that's there. Praying, fasting, offering. Now, when Paul shows up, what does Paul say? It's a good example for us. What do we say? We go to these places around the world. How do we lead? How do we begin the conversation? Here's how Paul starts it in Acts chapter 17. It says this: so he reasoned in the synagogue with the Jews and devout persons, and in the marketplace every day with those who happened to be there. Some of the Epicurean and Stoic philosophers also conversed with him, and some said, "What does this babbler wish to say?" Others said, "He seems to be a preacher of foreign divinities," because he was preaching Jesus and the resurrection. Now, what's interesting to me is that Paul goes to the academic hub of the Greco-Roman world, and what does he lead with? He leads with the message of the resurrection. That Jesus not only was crucified, that he went into the grave, but 3 days later, God miraculously raised him from the dead. Why does he lead with that kind of message? Well, think about who he's talking to. It says he's talking to two groups of philosophers, the Epicureans and the Stoics, two groups that, quite frankly, hated each other. But they're all gathering here around Mars Hill, and Paul sees the two groups and they're polarized. The only thing that the Epicureans and the Stoics agreed about was that death is death. They believe there was no resurrection, there's no life after death. You finish this life and that's all there is. The Epicureans were kind of one side of the coin. I'll show you a picture of their founder, a guy named, wait for it, Epicurus. So they were real creative in how they entitled their philosophy, right? So Epicurus was a guy, and he taught, listen, you only go around once in this world, so get all you can get, have a happy life, enjoy yourself all you can. That was kind of Epicurus's thought. Stoicism was a philosophy, and one of their main thinkers was the Roman leader Marcus Aurelius. I'll throw, again, a picture up there for you so you can see him. And Aurelius taught kind of just the opposite. He said, listen, you're only going to go one time through this world, so listen, do the right thing. Live in a righteous way, make right decisions, sublimate your emotions to your will and be disciplined. So on the one hand, you've got the Epicureans over here, and they're like, you know, write your own script, sing your own songs. And on the other hand, you've got the Stoics over here who are like, you know, do good for goodness sake. So you've got the Epicureans are the Democrats and the Stoics are the Republicans, right? That's kind of how it, isn't it amazing to you how the human heart works the same over and over and over and over again? Now, what did they have to say to Paul? When Paul starts to talk about the resurrection, it was just skepticism. What does this babbler have to say? They were just skeptical. And if you're here today and you're skeptical about the resurrection, that's cool. But what I would say to you is, you can't say that you're skeptical about the resurrection because, you know, we're modern people and we're way smarter than they were. But you can't say that. In some ways, I think they had a more difficult time believing in the resurrection. And in some ways, I think they had an easier time believing in the resurrection. I think in some ways it was tougher on them. I'll throw a picture up for you from Time Magazine. It's an article from 1995 that I've seen before and kept over time because it's a non-Christian writer talking about why he struggles to not believe in the resurrection. That's what part of the article is. And here's some of the things he says. He says, number one, if this whole resurrection thing, if it was all a hoax, that was just made up by some people, he's like, this is the worst hoax ever made. You would never make up a hoax like this. Because when Jesus is miraculously resurrected, raised from the dead, who are the first people who authenticate the resurrection? It's a group of women at the tomb. Well, in their world, females, their testimony wasn't even admissible in court. He's like, that'd be the last group, if you're gonna make up a hoax, that'd be the last group that you'd choose. He says, not to mention the fact that the disciples were a group of men who were really, really scared. They all run away, right, from Jesus. And then all of a sudden, after this resurrection thing happens, they go into all the world telling everybody, and they're willing to die for this message. Would anybody die for a hoax? Well, that didn't make sense. And then he says, not to mention the fact that in the scriptures, like when you read a book like 1 Corinthians, he says, you know, Paul says there are 500 people. 500 people who saw Jesus alive after he was crucified. And now we have manuscripts that date back within a decade or two of the actual event there that happened in Jerusalem with Jesus. I want you to think about there 500 people. You could go interview those people. If you were living at that time, you could go find those people, interview them, see what happened. So if it didn't happen, this whole thing should have been put to bed, put to rest a long time ago. When Paul's defending the resurrection in the book of Acts to the governor, the Roman governor there in Palestine, and King Agrippa. And he goes on in this defense of the resurrection. And finally, Festus, the Roman governor, says, listen, Paul, your much learning has made you mad, man. You're crazy. Here's how Paul responds to Festus and to Agrippa. He says, but Paul said, I am not out of my mind, most excellent Festus. For I am speaking true and rational words, for the king knows, he's King Agrippa, the king knows about these things, and to him I speak boldly, for I am persuaded that none of these things has escaped his notice, for this has not been done in a corner. King Agrippa, do you believe the prophets? I know that you believe. And Agrippa said to Paul, in a short time, you would persuade me to be a Christian. I love it. That in this moment, everything's on the line. Paul looks at King Agrippa and he says, listen, this was not done in a corner. I speak boldly to you about the resurrection. I'm not crazy. These are the most rational words that I could say. In other words, he's saying to King Agrippa, Agrippa, listen, prove it. If there's a dead man, there's a grave. And if there's a grave, there's a body. So go get the body of Jesus, bring it out into the streets, and prove that the whole thing is made up. But he couldn't do it. Agrippa knew it, and Paul knew it. And Agrippa's response to Paul's defense is, Paul, almost. Paul, you've got me this close to becoming a Christian. So I guess the question is, not so much, why did the people in their part of the world become believers? But the question is really more, why didn't all of the people in their world become believers? And here's the answer. The answer to why all the folks didn't want to believe the resurrection, because if the resurrection's true, you lose all control of your life. If the resurrection of Jesus is an actual historical fact, an event that actually happens, then you lose control of your life and I lose all control of my life. If the resurrection is true, what does it mean? Well, it means you lose all control of your financial life, for example. It means that in terms of generosity, you are no longer in charge of all the resources that God has given you, but he's in charge. If he was resurrected, if he came back from the dead, it means that you're no longer in charge of all your desires, your sexuality, all of that has to be surrendered to him, and it's not the way that you want to do it, it's the way that he wants to do it. Listen, all of your attitudes are surrendered to him, and how you deal with things like anger and all that, it's not your choice, it's his choice. If the resurrection is true, then you and I have lost all control. Now, that's a problem for us in the Western world, because we're so pragmatic. So what we want to do is we want to look at the resurrection and we want to look at it and say, well, you know what? If the resurrection helps me, then must be true. But the resurrection is not true because it works. It works because it's true. You see the difference in those things? So, what then is your struggle and my struggle with this whole idea of the resurrection? See, it's not just that you can study the resurrection as a historical fact or a historical fallacy, and there are lots of those things, but let's take it a step deeper than that. You see, I would say that part of the proof of the resurrection is that you and I need for the resurrection to be true. Because if the resurrection of Jesus is true, then your resurrection and my resurrection is true. Without it, if death is death, if that's all there is, then all you and I have is despair and anxiety. That's all we got, right? And there's a philosopher, a guy named Albert Camus, and he kind of said it this way. He said, let's say you're kidnapped, and your kidnapper says to you, in an hour, I'm gonna murder you, I'm gonna take your life. But for the last hour of your life, what's your favorite thing to do? So maybe for you, I don't know, watching football maybe is your favorite thing to do. I don't know, maybe it's reading, maybe it's listening to music. And so Camus says, your kidnapper says, okay, so for the last hour of your life, you know, here's a copy of the 2015 National Championship game, Ohio State versus Oregon, and you can watch that for the last hour of your life. Or he brings you a copy of Gone with the Wind, and he says, here, read a great book in the last hour of your life. Or here's an iPod with your faves on it, you know, so you can listen to music for the last hour of your life. Camus says, how much can you really enjoy that? How much can you really enjoy your favorite activity knowing that you're gonna die in 1 hour? He says, you're not gonna enjoy that. It's just gonna be despair. But then Camus says, back up and look at the spectrum of eternity. Look at how long we have been and how long we'll be. And if you look at the spectrum of eternity, what does that mean? That means that your life and my life is an infinitesimal small speck on the timeline of eternity. So what? So really, your life, my life, and the spectrum of eternity, we've got about an hour or so to live. And if death is death, and that's all there is, it's really just despair. All our greatest mountaintops are turned into valleys. Cosmically, eternally, it doesn't really mean anything. But it's not just despair. It's anxiety. Old Epicurus, right before he died, left the world with a quote. And I'll put it up here. I want to read it to you. It says, my biggest fear is not that death is the end, but that death perhaps is not the end. See, your biggest problem, if you think death is death and you're gambling all your chips on old Epicurus and his philosophy and his thought, is that there's this itchy anxiety that's right underneath your skin the closer that you get to death. And you think, but what if? What if? What if? What if it's true? For the Christian, somebody who's wrapped their heart around the resurrection, the heart of this gospel message that Jesus came and died for us because he had to, because we're all flawed and we're all sinful, but he also came and died for us because he wanted to, because he loved for us and cared for us and wanted to reconnect us with God. If we wrap our hearts around this resurrection-centered gospel, it's completely different. You look at your life through a completely different lens. So what? So what if your career doesn't go the way that you want it to go? You're gonna live for eternity and you are co-heir with Jesus to all the riches and wealth of heaven for eternity. So what? Your career didn't go the way you wanted it to go down here for, you know, a few months, few weeks, few... So what? Who cares? So what if somebody in this world doesn't like you? Who cares? You have the smile, the favor of God, the most powerful person in the universe to live with for eternity. So what if you start getting a little older and you start packing on a few extra pounds and your skin starts to wrinkle up a little more? You're gonna die, and for eternity, you're gonna have a perfect body. I want you to think about that this week. The closer you get to death, the older you get, the closer you get to perfection. Remind your spouse about that this week, okay? When you look at yourself in the mirror. Listen, for the Christian, it's a completely different perspective. So listen, you're here today and you say, you know what, Dean, I'm not a believer. I'm checking this thing out. Good for you. Please do that. Please keep checking it out. And I would encourage you, listen, doubt your doubts. Be skeptical of your skepticism and figure this thing out, because you're gambling a whole lot on old Epicurus and that idea that death is death. And you may get down close to the end and you may say, you know what, Dean, the way you're saying it today, boy, this is really making me think. And I'm like Agrippa. I'm really, really close. But there's not a lot of difference between this close and this far. There's got to come a moment where you cross the line of faith. And you may be here today and you may be a Christian and you may be thinking, Dean, I thought this was about missions. You've been talking about the resurrection. I thought we were talking about missions today. What does any of this stuff have to do with missions? Everything. Because listen, if you believe that the resurrection is true, then you believe that it is an injustice of cosmic, universal, eternal proportion that 2.8 billion people in the world don't have access to the message of the resurrection. And because of that, you're willing to adjust your life to God. And so during seasons, times, moments, you're willing to pray and you're willing to fast, like we're gonna do this week, for just a 24-hour period, to collect our hearts, to say to God, God, send more people to more places so that you get more praise throughout the nations. And I would just say that in a room this size, there are probably some of us who are here today. And you'd say, you know what, I've been a Christian for a while, Dean, and I would never say this out loud, but the truth is, Christianity has gotten kind of boring for me. I've heard all the passages, I've been to all the Bible studies, I've done all the Christian stuff, and I can't say it out loud, and I certainly wouldn't tell God this, but I'm just kind of bored. I would say to you that the reason you are bored with Christianity is that you've got no mission. You're not praying for anybody by name specifically that you're investing in, that's somebody that you work with, school with, family with, team with. You're not praying for anybody by name. You're not looking for opportunities to invest. You're not thinking about the world. You're not investing in the world. You're not even considering going somewhere else on a mission trip, get your feet on foreign soil to see what God is doing around and among the nations. And if you don't have that, I totally get it. Because what's the end run of Christianity? For you just to learn more stuff? I understand your boredom. See, to pray and to fast and to believe and to go and to receive people from the nations who are coming to our city is the end run of Christianity. It's the outworking of what God is working in us. Yeah, a few of us had the opportunity, I don't know, 4 or 5 months ago to go to a kind of a missions lab, missions intensive. And we were privileged to meet a guy named Jonathan there. Jonathan is the Christy Lowe at a large church in the Southeast. He's kind of their director of missions and engagement, global engagement. And as we were talking to him, he was telling us that I think it was a year or so ago that they were thinking, praying about how to reach a people group, an unreached people group called the Tajiks. Most of you probably never heard, up to that point, to be honest with you, I couldn't know that I could have recognized who the Tajiks were. There are about 16 to 20 million Tajik people around the world. And as much as we know, most, if not all of them, are completely unengaged with the gospel. Now, I want you to think about that. 16 to 20 million people-ish, this is an ish number, you could double the population of a state like Ohio, and that's the population of the Tajiks with little or no access to the gospel. So they tried to find people who were engaging the Tajiks. They live in Uzbekistan, Tajikistan, Iran, mainly Afghanistan, in those areas. And they just couldn't find anybody who were engaging these 16 to 20 million people. And so what Jonathan does is, because our churches are kind of part of a network, and there's about 45,000 churches who are part of our network, we've got a hub called the International Mission Board. So Jonathan, from his church in the Southeast, he calls the International Mission Board, and they reroute him to the guy that is going to give him the answer, right? And he says to the guy, look, we're thinking about praying about reaching the Tajiks. Is there anybody else that's doing that, another church that you know of among 45,000 or so churches that's doing that, that we can maybe partner with and work with? And the guy says, man, really, there's not. Now, he said about 6 months or so ago, another church called. It was kind of a small rural church over in East Tennessee, and they were asking some questions, but I don't know if they're doing anything. But I tell you what, he's like, I'll look in my email. If I can find it in my in one of my folders, I'll send you the email and you can call the pastor. Sure enough, sends him the email a little later on in the week. So Jonathan gets on his phone down here, southeastern United States. He calls rural East Tennessee, never talked to him before. Pastor picks up the phone. He says, hey, my name is Jonathan. I'm such and such church down here, and we're thinking about going overseas to reach the Tajiks people. And so somebody told me that maybe you guys were thinking about it. We were wondering if maybe we could work together to reach these 16 to 20 million people. And he said there was just silence on the other end of the phone. And all of a sudden he hears like the phone sounds like it's being dropped or it's being put down. And all he hears on the other end of the line is, praise God, glory to Jesus, hallelujah. And he's thinking, okay, maybe we don't need to work together. Maybe you all do your thing, maybe we'll do our thing. Sounds kind of weird, right? So this guy, this pastor from rural East Tennessee, picks up the phone after a couple of minutes of that shouting, and he says to him, he says, Jonathan, he says, we've been thinking, dreaming, praying about these Tajik people for a long time, but we're a small little rural church in Eastern Tennessee. And he said, we're saying, what can we do? So here's what we decided to do, Jonathan. We decided we were gonna pray and fast for 40 days. And we were gonna ask God, beg God, plead with God that he would send us somebody that could help us reach the Tajiks. And Jonathan, today is the 40th day of our 40-day fast. I want you to listen to me. We have got a big God who has got a big mission to reach a big world. And you and I get to be part of it. You know why? Because Iesus ha kurios. Because Jesus is Lord. And if that's true and the resurrection is true, then you and I have lost all control and we've gained eternal joy. Let's pray together. God, you are so kind to us. You give us grace upon grace upon grace. And God, I'm as certain as I can be that there are people who are here today who are a little bit skeptical, who have some doubts. And maybe, God, this morning as they've listened to your word, maybe your Holy Spirit has spoken to them. And so, God, I primarily pray for them first this morning, that this would be the moment where they cross the line of faith, that close wouldn't be close enough for them, that today, Lord, maybe this morning they'd be willing to take that step. That they'd be willing to receive this great gift of salvation that you provided on the cross and that you proved through the resurrection. As we just stay in that spirit and attitude of prayer right now, if that's you and you're here, you don't have a personal relationship with Christ, but you've come to this understanding this morning that Jesus died to bring you back to God so that while you feel far from God, it's not based on your work, but on his work on the cross. Anybody can come to him just like you are. If you wanna take that step this morning, I'd love to help you do that. I'm gonna pray up here. And if you wanna pray with me right there in your seat, you don't have to say it exactly like I say it. Pray in your own words if you want, or pray it just like I pray it. But just pray something like this. Dear Jesus, thank you for giving your life for me. Thank you for dying for me. Thank you for bringing me back to God. And Jesus, today I wanna say that you are Lord. You are in charge of my life. You're the boss of my life. Use it however you want to use it. Thank you for salvation. And again, we're just going to stay in that spirit, that attitude of prayer. But the scriptures are real clear that when you take this step, you don't do it in isolation. So I'm just going to ask that you would allow me to be the first person that you tell that you've done that just by slipping your hand up. Would you do that right now? Nobody's going to point at you, ask you a speech, anything like that. Would you just slip your hand up and say, yep, today was my day. Today was the day I crossed the line. I thank you. Just put them up and take them right back down. You don't have to hold them. Just put them up. Take them right back down. And then, God, I pray for the people in the room who maybe already believers, already Christians, but God, reality for them is they're just kind of bored. Lord, I pray this morning that you've stirred up a missionary fire in them. Lord, I pray that that what, God, they're going to walk away with this morning is there's this reality that they need to be part of the mission. And this week, they're going to pray and they're going to fast. And Lord, when it comes time, they're going to sacrifice and give for the sake of a big slice of our world who has little or no access to you. Jesus, you are Lord. And God, thank you. Thank you, thank you, thank you that I am not in control of my own life.